Lord Christ, by whose eternal sacrifice we exist and whose victory we triumph, grant that, in joy or in sorrow, we may never lose our grateful memory of thine unchanging love, who livest and reignest, God, throughout all ages. Amen. Well, hello. Hello, everyone. Today is Low Sunday. What can I say about Low Sunday? That's the Sunday immediately following Easter. What do the readings say? We just heard a prayer about gratitude. That's what I just recited. One of the readings, which I'm not going to go into at all, is chapter 10 of Luke's Acts, which has Peter proclaiming all kinds of things about God and Jesus. And there's finally Luke's gospel about Jesus appearing among his disciples in walking the road to Emmaus. It is only upon blessing and breaking bread with them that they recognize him. And of course, right then he departs from their sight. So when reading these stories, I know, just as you do, that they are a kind of, they're written in a kind of code where important things are hidden in plain sight, especially in names. So in this case, the name of Cleopas jumps out because he only appears in this story and is the only new character with a name. He is not one of the 12, is he? So his name is bound to be significant. Cleopas is often taken to mean glory of the Father. Glory in the sense of proclaiming, heralding, or propagandizing. That's the Cleo part, as in Cleopatra. Pas is usually said to be a contraction of patros, meaning father, making the name a declination of the masculine version of Cleopatra. But alas, in Greek, patros does not decline to pas. So the glory of the father meaning is, strictly speaking, incorrect. There is, however, a better fit for the name. The word pas is, in fact, in Greek, another version of the much more familiar pan, which means everything or all, making the name mean everything glorifies or proclaim everything. These meanings both fit with the story, as we shall soon see. Or perhaps even glorify all. Now, at first I thought Emmaus was a great clue because, again, it was one of the few named places given. And Judas Maccabees wins a famous battle of Emmaus against the Seleucids, leading to Simon Maccabees becoming the first Hasmonean king in 141 BCE. So I had visions of this really being about the Maccabees Mashiach Sangreal style. But it turns out I was wrong, because in the earliest extant versions of Luke, the town is not even called Emmaus, but Olamaus, which is quite a different place. And in fact, it is where God visited Jacob in a dream, which may indicate, perhaps, this Jesus encounter is not quite what it first seems to be. Now, Richard Carrier, who is a kind of famous academic biblical historian, suggests Luke is referencing, in true Hellenic style, the legend of Romulus, making this story yet another example of typological overlay, which is really what is all Pesherim. It's all that type of stuff. Now, I know someone will point out that Carrier is no friend of Christians or Christianity. Well, maybe. But let's say he is our enemy. If your enemy points out something that is obviously true, having determined it to be a weakness, and thinking it will demoralize you, should you get demoralized and then pretend what your enemy says is untrue? That's what the socialists, like the CCP and our wonderful ALP, do after all. and everybody loves them, right? McGowan and Albanese and that lovely Mr. Andrews, whom everyone just adores. Isn't it better to acknowledge the truth and make what your enemy deems weakness into a strength? I think a good Christian needs to realize these Christian romances are not history, but something far superior. They are teaching stories designed to put the listener and reader in touch with incredibly deep wisdom, which was the best of what was available from every culture then known. And in so doing, they who crafted these works hoped to convey even the spirit connection of that wisdom through time, so that when we hear these stories in the early 21st century, we who have ears can hear. Just as Paul says when he says he found Jesus in the scriptures, meaning Tanakh, the gospel writers found Jesus in all kinds of other literature and clearly wanted to include that in this new dispensation, this covenant for the Gentiles. We ought not to think of Richard Carrier as exposing a weakness by demonstrating a lack of historicity, which was, to be honest, it was never part of the original Christian belief, but only arose as a response by, shall we call them, the more thuggish and power-hungry elements of Christendom against their more sophisticated rivals in both the Hellenic Roman world and the Syro-Judean one. So instead, we should realize that Carrier is exposing one of the true strengths of Christianity, inclusiveness and loving kindness. So I want to address this matter head on. What is more important to getting people to be Christian, to behave like Christians, to be Christians? Having a rather questionable historical exegesis, or being inclusive, standing for loving kindness? This historicity, it's always been questionable, by the way, since its very beginning. The questioning began with a polemicist like Celsus in the second century, but continued and deepened through the majority of the Alexandrian church and most of Christianity east of the Jordan, which is why we lost them, the earliest and most true Christian churches for many centuries. The historicity was demanded by an Aristotelian approach to the law, L-O-R-E, so that you could have law, L-A-W. That is, historical exegesis was required in order to have a foundation upon which to base your creeds and rules for dominating your church membership. So I ask again, which is more important for Christianity's long-term gain as Christianity? Historicity or being more inclusive, kind, and loving? I leave the answer to this question up to you. At any rate, Carrier demonstrates the Christian overlay of the story of Proclus reasonably convincingly. In this legend, the legend of Proclus, recounted by both the Roman writers Livy and Plutarch, Proclus, which means proclaimer in archaic Latin, is journeying by road from Alba Longa to Rome when he meets a stranger. Rome is in turmoil because Romulus was recently killed and his body has vanished. What do you know? Doesn't that sound like something? On the journey, the stranger explains the secrets of the kingdom and how to conquer and rule the world before revealing himself to be the resurrected Romulus and then straightway ascending into heaven. Proclus, recognizing the stranger, goes on to proclaim what he was told. Compare this to Luke. Cleopas and companion meet a stranger in walking from Jerusalem to Emmaus. The stranger speaks to them about the secrets of the kingdom, in this case, kingdom of heaven. Cleopas and companion only realize the stranger is Jesus after his blessing and breaking bread as he is vanishing, but then go back to Jerusalem to proclaim the reality of the risen Lord. So that sounds like quite a superimposition. So why would Luke superimpose Jesus onto a Roman legend? Look, I don't know. But the living one, in my view, is definitely being equated in some way with Romulus. Why Romulus? What's so great about him? Maybe nothing, but he is interesting in that he is a twin. He and twin Remus were suckled by a she-wolf, you may recall from when you went to school. You may have heard that story. Well, the Gospels abound with twins. Judas Thomas means Judas the twin. Who's twin? The Gospels, James and John are twins. They're called the sons of Zebedee, that is, the sons of lightning, which is a roundabout way of saying the sons of Zeus, which makes them the Gemini twins, Castor and Polyducus. The Dioscuri, literally means Zeus's boys. Remember that Zeus is Zeus, is Deus, is Deus, which is God. So divine twinship, though, is something that has a very different meaning from what you might think. We're all supposed to have a divine twin. And before anyone starts getting all Blavatskyan, I don't mean the doppelganger or the desire body, if any of you know what that is. Your divine twin is your true higher self. So Romulus, perhaps, represents this higher self, making Jesus a kind of higher self to Luke's characters, perhaps. And I was almost going to leave this talk there, but there was this other nagging thing inside me. Because I always like to put myself in the position of the ignorant disciples rather than an omniscient reader-spectator. But I asked myself, how many times do I miss the risen Lord when I am with people I don't know and even people I do know, especially people I do think I know? I can't help but feel that the story really means we are on journeys, traveling from one place to another, traveling through life, along the way, meeting other people. And usually we do not recognize them for who they are, because we do not recognize the divine when it's right in front of our eyes. I mean, we are the ones traveling to Emmaus. We are the ones who do not recognize the risen Lord in our midst. We are the ones who discover Jesus just as he is leaving, begging him to stay, but stay he will not. That's us. How many times do you and I stop and say to ourselves, that person we know is the risen Lord? February, you are the risen Lord. Samuel, you are the risen Lord. Breaking bread before my eyes, you are the risen Lord. How many times do I say that? Precious few, isn't it? Precious few. Our eyes are scaled shut. We do not see Christ when he is with us. We do not see Christ in our midst. We do not see him because we are too much about ourselves. We are too involved in ourselves, our worries, our cares, our wants, especially our wanting to be special, in wishing or hoping for others to realize how special we are. And indeed, we are special, just not the way we hope. Listen, I invited a friend of mine to a Tai Chi workshop that my teacher was putting on because I wanted to support it and because I believe it's truly valuable as my friend. So I thought it would be valuable to my friend. My friend went, I don't want to put myself in the student position at this stage of my Tai Chi. I really couldn't believe he actually wrote that, but there it was on my phone. And I thought, but in Tai Chi, aren't you always a student? Isn't that the very point of Tai Chi? That you look for people you can learn from, and that is the same with anything in the spiritual life. Yet, you know, when everyone wants to be in charge and everyone wants to teach and no one wants to be taught, no one wants to take the lower position, no one thinks anyone else is qualified, but figure they are, this is spiritual pride. No one wants to take the other position of being the inferior. And yeah, it's natural. It's natural. Yet if no one takes the inferior position, the interested position, the student position, not only will no one learn anything, but there will be no community. So if we want there to be a vibrant, growing community, we all must take the lower position, not just some of us, all of us. We all must be interested in what others can teach us, others we don't know, and others we think we do know. How do we recognize Christ in our midst, in each other? Someone will contend that they already do. But in my observing of faces and manners, I know it is no more than an extremely occasional experience. Certainly it is that way for me. So I ask, why isn't it our daily experience? What are we missing in our daily practices that we don't feel the divine in each other? Must be because them other people aren't divine, right? I'm divine, but not you, huh? You know, either everyone's divine or no one is. If no one is, then we're materialists and we should all just go home. If everyone is, what are we doing in our interactions to put ourselves in touch with that experience? Because it's the direct experience that counts, not a bunch of words. Not this bunch of words. A bunch of words is just a story. And no story, no matter how beautifully told, is any substitute for direct experience of the divine. And I like well-told stories. Just ask my children. If we want to be in the presence of the risen Lord, and I believe that since we're here, we do, we could do a lot worse than looking for and finding only the good things in the people around us, only the good things. And I know some people make it so difficult. But so what? If you and I are special, and we are, then surely we're special enough to find only the good things in other people around us. But you have to seek for only the good things. What you seek, you find. If you want to be miserable, look for how badly you're being treated or how badly misunderstood you are. That will make you miserable, and then you can be a magnet for misery. If you want to be surrounded by love, you have to begin by loving. First yourself, the self, who is really none other than your connection to your Father in heaven, then this becomes love for one another, naturally. Some people claim to send love. If you are sending something, calling it love, then you probably want to stop doing that. Love cannot be sent, because love already is everywhere. If you're sending it, that's more spiritual pride. You can love another only through the extension of love of the Father, of the One. Anyone who's been in love knows this to be true. Love moves through you and around you, not from you. Love is between you and others. Love requires no externally directed effort to be, only softening or releasing to be experienced. Eventually you can be love, but really, we are still a way off that being any more than a temporary reality. Some of us do experience it from time to time, but it is temporary for almost all of us. And how is this accomplished? By taking the lower position, softening rather than puffing up or adding things you hope and wish are true. The one who always gratefully takes the lower position is the one who is in touch with love and therefore in touch with the Bridegroom, the Living One. when you glorify all, everyone, and everything, you glorify the Father, and then you begin to touch the kingdom. Thank you for listening, guys. Thank you.